up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. And today we've got Hunter Marsden, still in America.
Hey, hey.
Tejas Menon.
What's up?
And Jake Dello. Jake's audio is on a slight, lag. Slight lag. All right. So two quick hits before we get into it. The first is BBC had this report. It's really fucking weird story about a Chinese couple who are notionally civilians, I guess, who were bribing officials in the Marshall Islands to create a special autonomous zone or something that would allow China to invest in the Marshall Islands. And politicians in the Marshall Islands are famously corrupt. So much so that the bribe amounts that we're talking about are like $10,000, $20,000. This is like chump change, right? But it goes a long way in the Marshall Islands. The reason the story gets any attention at all is, of course, the context of Sino-US rivalry. But this whole thing is really small potatoes and ham-fisted. Like, this is not super intelligent by itself, and there's really no threat here. So one, because we are talking about economic investment, this is not a Chinese military base, not threatening, right? Two, the Marshall Islands is part of a formal U.S. sphere of influence, okay? The U.S. controls the Marshall Islands' foreign relations and national security. So there's zero chance that China's going to, like, infiltrate American control in this place. It's legally set up to prevent that, right? So what was remarkable to me in this story is, like, the State Department responded to this, right? They were talking about how China was trying to subvert the Marshall Islands' sovereignty. Like, how dare they? Which could not be more of, like, pot calling the kettle black. So the Marshall Islands' sovereignty is formally circumscribed by being part of America's sphere of influence, man. Okay, through the Compact of Free Association. That's what it specifies. So this incident, in a strategic sense, is kind of nothing. It's like, if you're going to view it in the maximally dark way, it's a probing of intentions, like an economic equivalent of, you know, PLA incursions into an ADIZ or something. But that's if you're going to be like totally cynical, malign, paranoid reading, right? Really, I saw in this an opportunity to show the hypocrisy that drives the U.S. side of Sino-U.S. rivalry, right? It's not that there's nothing going on that's in a competitive spirit or a zero-sum spirit. There is. It's that you can choose to be like, meh, or you can choose to, like, hyperventilate about it, right? And, you know, doing the latter is not going to get us anywhere. So, and the idea that you would narrate all of this without mentioning the fact that the Marshall Islands is part of a U.S. sphere of influence just reeks of, like, not just propaganda maybe, but like a massaged narrative that smoothed out inconvenient truths left out, you know? So I just thought I'd share it because it's a weird story and it has a lot of threads in it that we hit on from time to time here.
Yeah, super weird story. What really surprised me was the fact that the two who were arrested were operating an NGO out of New York. So that's probably the reason they came on the FBI's watch list in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's like, what are you guys doing? You know, they're charged with money laundering and I forget the other charges exactly, bribery and foreign corruption. But it seems like they probably could have gotten a lot further along with getting away with this without operating an NGO out of New York, where the FBI is, has a heavy presence. So not really sure whose idea that was.
It's very clumsy, to say the least. Anyways, second quick hit is no less crazy, but I don't know, very surprising in a way, I guess. I have to give a shout out to Alexander McCoy for flagging this. There was a YouGov poll, and Alex just circulated a screenshot of some key findings from the poll, and it was fucking nuts. And to be honest, I'm not sure what I want to say about this. Like, it's so crazy that maybe I'll just read off a few things and then get y'all's reactions. Okay, so it says the YouGov poll screenshot. It's like, many dire scenarios for the U.S. seem likely in the next decade to more Republicans than to Democrats, but still also to Democrats, right? So the poll asks, how likely do you think it is that the following things will occur in the next 10 years in the U.S.? There will be a total economic collapse. 38% of Democrats think that. 65% of Republicans think that, right?
That's wild.
A total economic collapse. That would be worse than the Great Depression. That's like going back to feudalism. Completely apocalyptic. And 65% of Republicans expect that. What does it do to your like death drive when you already expect that it's we're inevitably going back to feudalism? What does that do for you just being a good normal citizen who doesn't shoot people on the bus on the way to work, right? Like, why would you restrain yourself in civil society if you think civil society is going to not exist in a few years, you know? So like, there's a danger in that kind of thing, but that's not it. There's others, right? The U.S. will no longer be a global superpower. 55% of Democrats say that. 56% of Republicans say that. Bipartisan view. Federal government will confiscate citizens' firearms in the next 10 years. 17% of Democrats, 48% of Republicans. There will be a civil war between people who are Republicans and Democrats in the next 10 years. 35% of Democrats think this, civil war. 45% of Republicans think this. 45% of Republicans, let's be honest, are saying they're going to do civil war. So like that's not totally surprising, right? This is the nutty one. The U.S. will be invaded by a foreign country in the next 10 years. 24% of Democrats think that. 41% of Republicans think that. That America will be invaded by a foreign country. Who? Who's going to? It's fucking Red Dawn nonsense, man. I just like, the U.S. will become a fascist dictatorship. Well, yeah. It's about a third of Democrats and Republicans. Oh, a civil war between people of different races, not just between Republicans and Democrats. I bet there's a lot of overlap there. But 31% of Democrats and 31% of Republicans think there will be a race war. Oh, the U.S. will become a communist dictatorship. 31% of Republicans think that. Only 13% of Democrats.
That's fairly low.
Yeah. So they sliced the civil war risk by multiple dimensions, right? Like one is Republicans versus Democrats. One is whites versus everybody who's not white. And then there was another one of rich versus poor. That would be a class war, by the way. And that would be 25% of Democrats, 37% of Republicans. Also civil war between urban versus rural areas. So city folk against country folk. 20% of Democrats, that seems, yeah, that's a silly fucking way to parse it. But 20% of Republicans and 23% of Democrats think that that's going to happen. So this is just like, you see, this is psychopathy. What do you make of this? What, I don't even know what there is to say, you know?
Yeah, I'm not surprised by a great deal of this, given, you know, if you read like the New York Times these days, it's all about the end of American democracy, the rise of fascism, you know, the polarization in our society and sort of, what I called Civil War doom porn last episode we recorded together. I am surprised so many Republicans say they expect total economic collapse to happen. I'm not surprised Republicans are much more concerned the government's going to confiscate guns. That's a message, political narrative that they've been spinning for decades. Yeah. So apparently it's taken hold. Not surprising there. I think there was some video during the campaign for the 2020 election where someone confronted Biden on the campaign trail and said, you know, you're going to take away our guns. And he said, what are you talking about? I'm not going to do that. And, you know, had to make sort of a performative appeal to gun rights. I'm not surprised that Republicans are far more likely by a margin of 12 percentage points that they say there will be a civil war. I am a bit surprised by the last one you mentioned, that there will be a civil war between people living in cities and people in urban areas, that both of those figures are comparatively lower to civil war expectations of a civil war between the rich and poor, between different races. Because it seems to me that so much of our political divide in the last couple elections came down to sort of the red map, blue map stuff that is projected on national media. So maybe that narrative hasn't taken hold as much. Although, you know, you would think by the January 6th sort of coverage that there is a real divide there, people coming in from out of the city and, you know, the sort of country folk from the hills, real America, you know, not seeing things the way the East Coast elite do, per se. But perhaps that's not as real as, you know, the media makes it out to be.
Well, there are lots of divisions in society, and that's, I guess that's one of the divisions, but it's like, which divisions are Civil War worthy? And it's like the fact that you live in the country or that like you live in a fucking high rise, that's not a reason to go offing your fellow man, you know, like the racial stuff. I can see it, you know, Democrats versus Republicans. It is very tribal. So like maybe, but yeah. Yeah, not all divisions are worth I don't know, suicide bombing over.
Right. No, absolutely. I guess I just think of the rural urban divide oftentimes now mapping with political divide or partisan divide.
Yeah.
You drive out. I've spent a lot of time back in America this summer, and you know, driving through rural parts of even blue states, you see all these anti-Biden and pro-Trump signs. It's just, you know, it's like, why does everyone care so fucking much about politics? As everybody's up in arms here, it's crazy.
Yeah, totally. I mean, can you even just like 5 years ago, I don't want to keep this going, can you imagine a poll like this? The apocalyptic mindset is really dangerous for what you end up deciding. It's like very obviously a self-fulfilling prophecy risk here, so not good. But I mean, there this is one of the dangers of like being obsessed about conspiracy theories in the first place. Like, you're not moored to any kind of like rationality, you know? Dangerous.
Alrighty. Let's get into the next segment, eh? I haven't been on the pod for a hot minute, but for those, but the segment keeps going on. So I'm sure everybody who's listening kind of knows what the segment is.
We'll just Except for me.
Straight into it. So give you three headlines and you have to figure out which one the fake one is.
Okay. All right.
So, the first one, Lebanese woman holds up a bank to access frozen savings as anger boils. Second, public outcry in India as citizens claim the president's trip to attend the Queen's funeral is a waste of taxpayer money. And the third one is two reported killed in clashes between Kyrgyz and Tajik border guards.
Oh my God. I have no idea. I have not heard of any of these headlines, any of these storylines. So the third one was Kyrgyz Tajik border guards clashing.
Yeah.
The first one was a Lebanese woman holding up a bank. And then the second one was the Indian prime minister going to the UK for the Queen Elizabeth death and people being pissed about that. I'm going to say that the Indian thing is false because I have a hard time seeing the Prime Minister of India going to commemorate the Queen.
Yeah, you got it right. I thought I stumped on this one.
I thought Modi had a very pro-monarchy tweet or announcement about the Queen's death.
I missed it.
Yeah. Yeah. So she is actually going, just no one's upset about it.
Oh, so I was right for the wrong reasons. That's that's like Trump North Korea policy. Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, because like India's whole history is like they're fucking. You actually talk to somebody who's Indian too. Like, I have friends who are Indian. They're all fucking pissed at the British, and like rightfully so. You know. As a historical matter, right? As an oppressive matter. Modi is like half a fash himself. So like maybe, you know, being pro-monarchy is not totally surprising. But I would have thought that the Indian people would be upset about that. And it sounds like nobody's kicking up fuss about that.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of a headline, I added on to it that people were upset because my dad sent me the article being like, what the hell? So as Indians, yes, we're all like not super in touch with the monarchy.
Oh, my bad, dude. I totally forgot you're also Indian.
yeah. But hey.
Sorry.
No. It's all good. And I mean, I saw this good... I know we live in New Zealand and stuff, and three of us at least, yeah. and you know, over here people really do care about it, and to each their own, you know. But I think it's important when talking about the monarchy that different people have different relations to it, and certainly former colonies like India and certain places in Africa, and even in New Zealand and Pacific Islands, all have their own sort of spin and sort of perspectives on the monarchy and how they feel about it.
Yeah, I'm super, obviously not surprising, like extremely rabidly anti-monarchical. It's one of the things I hate most about New Zealand, in fact. But you pick your moments. You don't press that kind of republicanism at a moment when somebody's like romantic figure has died. Like, you know, it's not smart. It's also possibly not kind. Yeah. So like, yeah. I've said basically nothing about the Queen's death, but you know where my head probably is. All right, for Stay Off Twitter this week, Seva Gunitsky, University of Toronto, leads off with a thread about inflation. He says, not an economist, he's an IR scholar, so please explain if I'm getting something wrong because it feels like I'm taking crazy pills. Due to supply chain issues and the Russia-Ukraine war, things cost more, especially basic things like fuel and food. As a result of these price increases, inflation goes up. To deal with this, the government raises interest rates. This helps freeze real wages and increase unemployment while making things like mortgages more expensive. People now have less money to spend on everything and spend more money on things like paying off debts. Since consumer demand now decreases while supply ostensibly stays the same, this should curb price increases, lowering inflation. The side effects, quote unquote, are triggering a recession and massively increasing poverty rates. What the fuck? As insane as this all seems, it's still not clear to me how interest rate increases will get people to spend less on basic necessities like food and gas. That is, it doesn't make sense to me how this policy will work on its own terms. What am I missing here? The tool, what I wanted to highlight was like raising interest rates, which is what central banks and the Fed do. It's like their tool of choice for dealing with inflation, but it's totally orthogonal to being able to manage inflation. Like, it depends on why inflation was happening, and doing things like Seva is pointing out a very salient point, which I'm literally facing myself. Like, as interest rates increase, literally my mortgage is increasing because there are no fixed rate mortgages in New Zealand. Everything's floating rate. So as rates go up, everybody pays more. Like, you can't have a fixed rate mortgage for more than like a year or two at a time. So people pay more, but that doesn't mean they're going to buy less bread. It doesn't mean they're going to drive their car less. It doesn't mean they're going to use less electricity, right? So everything that you consume that's not a vacation, basically, is going to still be consumed at the same rate. And so you're not doing anything to address inflation that's coming from consumption or from demand. Right. And so the interest rate raising tool is just like not well matched to the concerns about it or the reasons why it's being driven up in the first place. Inflation, that is. So this is all pushing us toward an economic recession. This is increasing unemployment and suppressing worker wages, this process of raising interest rates. And yet it doesn't really address inflation unless you create a recession. But it's like, is that what you want? Who wants that? Oligarchs maybe want that. Average person doesn't want that. So that's the reality that we're being dealt with. And like, so the central banks and the Fed are this like hyper political actor that directly affects most individual people. but somehow they're wildly politically unaccountable. And people's collective ignorance about the Fed and about interest rates and about how central banks work works to their advantage, allows them to be unaccountable. So it's like, short of like causing a war, the central banks or the Fed are like one of the most powerful actors that will affect your life directly. And yet, like, most people go around not even realizing it. So that was just like the main thing that I wanted to flag.
Yeah, I think that sums it up well.
Hunter, could you read the Chris Murphy tweet? Do you have that one up?
I do. Yeah, thread? It's 9 parts. So this is a tweet from Chris Murphy, Democratic senator from Connecticut. He starts out by saying, U.S. foreign policy often builds like a runaway bowling ball. An idea gets rolling, develops uncontrollable momentum, and then before anyone really has evaluated the idea's merit, it's knocking over everything. This could be happening today on Taiwan policy. Let me explain. For decades, the U.S. has helped secure peace on the island of Taiwan, largely because of a policy through which we A, neither recognize Taiwan's independence nor recognize China's claim to Taiwan, and B, help Taiwan defend itself without explicitly guaranteeing their security. 3, our policy is purposely fuzzy, and it has worked. But now things are changing. China is getting more aggressive, undermining and isolating Taiwan, building up its military, flexing left and right, hinting at an invasion in the near future. 4, in this context, our Taiwan policy must, all caps, change. We need to expedite and increase arms sales. We should help Taiwan join international bodies. We should sanction Chinese officials who undermine Taiwan. We should fight Chinese anti-Taiwan propaganda. But many in Congress and the think tank ecosystem argue that the U.S. must go much further by ending strategic ambiguity, recognizing Taiwan, and promising to fully defend Taiwan if China invades. A full reversal of decades of bipartisan consensus on Taiwan policy. It's a policy that looks strong and tough on China, but does it actually protect our interests? The answer is no. Recognizing Taiwan doesn't actually protect Taiwan. It will just enrage our allies and possibly provoke China into retaliation and a quicker invasion. Further, there's no need for an explicit defense guarantee. China has already priced in a full U.S. defense if they invade, so what do we get by making Taiwan's defense our explicit policy? Again, it's tough talk without enough upside to counter the provocatory downside. And 8 of 9, it's fair to counter that we shouldn't make policy based on China's irrational hurt feelings. Okay, but our China portfolio isn't just Taiwan. It's trade, human rights, North Korea, climate, fentanyl, etc. Shouldn't we consider how Taiwan policy changes affect the whole portfolio? Bowling balls are hard to stop. We've seen it over and over, Vietnam, Iraq, Syria, etc. Leaders often don't want to look weak by questioning paths to conflict. But here, we can step up efforts to protect Taiwan without totally throwing out decades of successful policy.
That's a long-ass thread, man. But I like it. It's like basic, the thrust of the tweet is that policy is thrusting in a direction or drifting in a direction that's not well considered, not thought out. And to the extent you think it through, the case for abandoning things like strategic ambiguity in favor of, you know, overt threat making about deterring China, well, the math doesn't quite add up there. You know, within his own context, he's kind of ringing alarm bells about this drift or this trend. And I think that's all fair. I think that makes sense. I think he concedes a little bit too much in the whole, like, we must make change to China policy or whatever. Like, the things that he mentions that we must do is all the shit that we've been doing. I mean, for like decades, even when we were in the detente mode with China, we were doing stuff like fighting Chinese propaganda and selling arms to Taiwan. So like, I think the idea that like our policies toward China must change is something that needs to be argued and demonstrated. And I don't think he made that case there. And certainly I'm on board with the argument that like strategic ambiguity needs to hold. Unfortunately, the status quo, the historical status quo with regard to China and Taiwan is like the best thing for stability for the foreseeable future until something shifts, you know? So I don't know. I thought he was making a good point here.
Yeah, I'm with you. I watch, you know, for instance, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee just approved of Taiwan Policy Act, which has significant legislative items such as expanded defense sales, sanctions mm-hmm. against China, that defense sales to Taiwan, that is, and all sorts of stuff bolstering our security relationship with Taiwan, which, you know, in some sense sort of puts the pressure on the Biden administration to fall in line and support this stuff or act tougher to sort of, you know, stay strong politically, domestically, because if the House and Senate are seen to be acting, you know, in such a way that is tougher on China than the White House, you know, there's all sorts of awkward political tension there. And it makes me very apprehensive. You know, I tend to be a bit bullish on the Taiwan relationship and, you know, support it generally. But some of these things like multi-billion dollar defense sales are not really thought through in such a way that actually protects Taiwan. This is what I liked about Senator Murphy's last tweet. I think he said something about, you know, we need to look at ways we can defend Taiwan that don't just involve the military dimension. And primarily that, in my mind, comes down to expanding trade cooperation and getting Taiwan into international bodies, which hasn't really worked super successfully. But in any, at any rate, I don't think putting Taiwan in the spotlight here by sort of moving quickly to sort of shore up our defense relationship is good for either Taiwan or the U.S.-China dimension or U.S.-China-Taiwan strategic triangle here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the irony or the paradox, Pacific Power Paradox coming soon to a bookstore near you. The irony is that, like, making changes or changing the trajectory of the defense relationship with Taiwan in a more assertive direction or, like, a more aggrandizing direction, I think that, to me, is the thing that, because of how China reacts to that, is the thing that's most destabilizing of all. Like, it's the thing that puts Taiwan most in the barrel or most under the gun sights, bore sights. The other stuff, like trying to get Taiwan back into international community, like, that's just good sense. I mean, like, that stuff is not harming the strategic situation, I don't think. We're in trouble because the conventional wisdom is sort of drifting in the wrong direction. And I think that's what Chris or Senator Murphy was responding to. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. He's probably sitting in all of these backroom meetings where the head nodding consensus is getting like hawkier and hawkier. And so I think we should heed the warning there. Anyways, that was good. All right. I just have one tweet. It's pretty short. From Murtaza Hussein, who writes at The Intercept. And he says, I still consider the high watermark of what felt like fascism in the United States, the Bush-Cheney years. Extrajudicial disappearances, state-sanctioned torture, expanding list of wars, most of the media transformed into cheerleading zombies. Nothing compares with that. These arguments, these aesthetics and norms feel really vacuous and narcissistic. Substantively speaking, the Bush years had the most practical steps taken toward an actual fascist government, including attempts to legally grant the executive absolute power. This is, I think, it's interesting because, like, I take his point, and I think he's raising something interesting, which is that, like, Bush-Cheney was, like, way more dystopian and terrifying than I think we often remember, because the aesthetic of Trump was so anti-democratic and, like, so in your face about it. And their Bush-Cheney aggression, fascism, was, like, had this, like, veneer of civility over the top of it that made it more digestible, particularly if you were, like, a certain kind of person, you know. If you were a Muslim or somebody who looked Muslim-ish, you were probably feeling like what Murtaza is saying, which is that, like, that's the high water mark of fascism. You know, you go to your mosque and the FBI is surveilling you and wiretapping you. And, like, people really were disappearing and thrown into jails and shit. So, like, the apparatus of, like, a kind of totalitarian state was being constructed in gangbusters under Bush and Cheney. But there wasn't a mass fascist movement in the Bush-Cheney years. The populist energy that was, like, pro-fascist, that is a thing now. That's something that, like, Trump, like, helped unlock. The Bush-Cheney years didn't do anything to help that, you know? Like, you have the war on terror and then the war comes home, you know? But in the Bush-Cheney years, that populist fascist energy was just not quite present yet. So I appreciate, I don't know if I fully agree with the statement that, like, Bush Cheney was more fascist than Trump, whatever his name was, Mike Pence. But there's definitely like a relationship there. And the tweets sparked off like a debate among people who were like generally like-minded, but disagreed with each other about this. I thought it was interesting.
I think I might just jump in a little bit. I think it's also interesting to look at the context of in both eras. Obviously, Bush Cheney, their sort of fascism was juxtaposed against 9/11, right? And caused this mass paranoia. We lived in the U.S. at the time, and a lot of what, you know, we're Indians, we're not Muslim either, but a lot of, you know, that kind of...
like everybody confused Sikhs for Muslims, and
exactly. So you know, we dealt with that, and then also in terms of the Trump Pence era or the administration, it's juxtaposed on against this sort of increasingly marginalized middle class that isn't people of color, a white middle class that's marginalized by neoliberal economics and things like that. Is sort of coming to the forefront, which maybe was at its inception in the early noughts. And so it's really, really cool to sort of compare the two contexts within which the sort of fascism is happening and see how they sort of manifest differently.
Yeah, there's a book by, I want to say, Thomas Oatley. In 2015, he wrote this, which is like in before times. But he basically argued that spending on military superiority, like running deficits, the way we've been doing it since the 80s, like where you run big deficits in order to pay for military superiority, that was actually a cause of recurring financial crisis. So every financial crisis that we've had since the 80s has been tracked, including the global financial crisis in 08, traces back to this need to like structurally sustain deficit spending through foreign borrowing to pay for military superiority, which is an interesting argument. And to the extent that that's correct, it's a Cambridge book, no less. But to the extent that that's correct, it's showing how like the war on terror apparatus creates the economic insecurity, you know, it exacerbates like neoliberalism basically. So the over time, that populist reactionary energy just like builds and builds. And then Trump was the great inheritor of that. Interesting points all around. All right. Are we ready for armchair?
All right. For this week's armchair analysis, we have a segment by Nigel Inkster, which sounds like the best British pseudonym I've ever heard. It's in the New York Times and it's titled, China is running covert operations that could seriously overwhelm us. So Mr. Inkster is the former director of operations and intelligence at British MI5. And he talks about sort of the evolution of his time and awareness of China as a threat to national security in the UK. I think he came to a senior role during the Cold War because he sort of says, you know, when he started out, China was not seen as a threat. It was not really taken seriously. More recently, under Xi Jinping, Beijing has expanded the sort of remit of the United Front Work Department and oversees global intelligence gathering, yada, yada, yada. He says the culture of the Chinese Communist Party has always been a clandestine or has always had a clandestine nature. China can best be described as an intelligence state. The party views the business of acquiring and protecting secrets as an all-of-nation undertaking. I think some of this is right. You know, if you look at the history of the Communist Party, right, it started as sort of a guerrilla group, Maoist revolutionary sort of ideology, right? Intelligence was survival. I'm not sure if it still really operates that way, right? That China has evolved in so many ways and dimensions on a global scale. And I'm sure its intelligence gathering methods have become a lot more sophisticated. It's also stopped directly interfering in, say, Southeast Asian states by supporting sort of communist parties and insurgent groups to fight against central governments and destabilize their neighbor, China's neighbors. So a great deal has changed. And at the same time, as the international community has sort of gained recognition of China's growing capabilities, some countries have just totally freaked out, right? So we've done things like label Huawei and different Chinese technology sensitive or a threat to national security and banned them outright, or had these debates playing out in sort of European parliaments. And the article mentions the Trump administration's China Initiative, which was an FBI program preventing or designed to prevent the theft of economic and scientific intelligence from US universities, which in some ways backfired completely by alienating and pushing out some
of super fucking racist.
Yeah, exactly. Man. A racist program which pushed out and alienated some of our most talented talent that we were attracting to the sciences and universities in the United States. So what do we do about this? How can we react rationally? Well, Mr. Inkster says there are tools Western intelligence and security agencies can start using, including providing staff members with the requisite language skills and an awareness of China and the workings of the Chinese Communist Party. I think that's great, right? Educate people, get area experts and people who know Chinese working on these issues. I think to a large extent, we already do that. Then he sort of veers off in a fuzzy direction, you know, as an 800-word op-ed inevitably does. It doesn't go into a great amount of detail on what Mr. Inkster is proposing that we do radically different here. And generally, he's saying we need to have more balls and get involved in offensive capabilities, not be afraid to go on the offensive with intelligence collection, which made me think back to, I think it was probably a decade ago now, where the Chinese Communist Party rounded up a whole bunch of U.S. intelligence assets in China and killed most of them or disappeared them or maybe kicked some out of the country if any survived. So I'm not sure what the extent of those capabilities remains for Western governments in the U.S. in China at this point. And Inkster says the West shouldn't be afraid to make bold moves. Like, what is he talking about exactly? And he offers no specifics and policy recommendations. So I'm still scratching my head there. You know, he does sort of revert to the idea that we should prioritize values of freedom, openness, and lawfulness, right? I think that's important, but sort of a symbolic gesture here. And, you know, despite the title, I think it's not all just sort of threat and fear mongering in this piece. I think some of it is a bit sober and balanced. But when it comes to sort of the what do we do now, I think he's sort of, it's a slippery slope. When we get into offensive capabilities, right, then we're encouraging our adversaries to do the same thing to us. And the U.S. has been trying to call attention to China's bad practices. You know, we mentioned these spies or influence agents of influence in the Marshall Islands. I'm not sure where to draw the line there, personally.
Yeah, I fucking hated this piece, dude. It didn't say anything that I didn't know. Like, who in the world of, like, paying attention to foreign relations doesn't know about the perniciousness of the United Front? Like, who thinks that's, like, just an innocent, you know, non-CCP organization doing good works or something? It's not like a charity organization, you know? So, like, this piece had the function for me of, like, it's basically Red Scare propaganda, you know? The public is the audience. It doesn't serve any purpose, particularly because it's not saying anything new, except to create a climate of fear and hate and mistrust. That seems to be the, like, meta goal, but also, like, occasionally he says kind of that outright. Like, that's what he's saying when he's saying you need to, like, wake up or be more sober. Like, he's saying to be more fearful, to be more mistrustful, right? And we already have plenty of that because the CCP sucks. And the United Front is, like, a very anti-democratic instrument of the CCP, right? So I don't have a ton to say, you know. I will say it makes a bunch of characterizations about China and comparisons to the Soviets that are, like, straight up not correct. So, like it said, the Soviet Union was isolated and poor throughout the Cold War. And that's just false. That's a lie. In the 80s, the Soviets were poor. In the early Cold War, the Soviets were, like, a manufacturing powerhouse, you know? And throughout the entire Cold War, the Soviet Union was not isolated. It was, like, a third of humanity. So, like, what the fuck are you talking about?
By comparison to China, though, to be clear, Soviet Union did not have the economic heft and share of world wealth that China makes up currently.
So in the 80s, that's true, but that's not true throughout the Cold War. That's one of the reasons why America was, like, so freaked out about Soviet communism, is because they had a form of political economy that in the beginning of the Cold War was, like, extremely effective. But like the nature of political economy changed by the 70s, right? But anyways, like he makes a bunch of minor characterizations that are like, this isn't correct. What are you doing? You know, when you have a stack of those, it raises questions about like, well, what's the larger point that you're trying to make? It's like it creates a kind of posture of disingenuousness. But like the only other point I would have is that all of this cloak and dagger spook stuff, Chinese influence efforts, FBI and CIA counter efforts, I don't take any of this stuff lightly. And one of the reasons is because like it's impossible to step up your game and go on the offense and have a free and open democratic society. You're lying through your teeth when you talk about values and principles about what you're defending when you do that stuff. Okay. So the problem I have that spy versus spy is inevitable, you know, when you construct relationships of rivalry, responding to that situation of rivalry with Red Scare tactics and fomenting more fear and hate and mistrust, man, he's asking us to like wake up and then create the world that we most fear, you know? And like when I see op-eds like this, this is why it's like hard for me to take it seriously, because there is an actual political purpose to what's being written there, separate from what the content says, you know? And when the content itself is not new, it's doubly serving that political purpose. It's climatic. It's trying to create a culture that constrains everything, right? It's like the worst kind of propaganda. So, and the trouble is that China is kind of a malign actor in this way. It's just that it's not like, so it's not something to dismiss. It's just not new. It's really not the public's concern to a great extent. That part I think is dodgy. It's creating like a justification layer for things like the FBI's China initiative, which is the only way that you're going to go on the offense, quote unquote, is by doing stuff like that, which is self-defeating if what you hold dear is democracy. You know, so yeah, I found the piece problematic, I guess.
Also, in terms of the title, you know, I wonder what the editor was thinking there.
Oh yeah,
covert operations.
Titles are fucking.
I get nitpicky with titles, but could seriously overwhelm us. Like, what is that telling me? I don't get anything from that.
Not that's about as scary as it gets. Covert and overwhelming. What? I'm shitting my pants right now. You know.
Cool. Let's do the AMA. So from Natalie S, question one, what do you think of newsletters, especially Substack? And a follow on from that question two, are you going to start a newsletter? You said on Twitter that you were probably going to bite the bullet.
Yeah. As a trend, I don't like the newsletters, this like atomization of information, you know, but fighting trends is like not good strategy, generally speaking. So the question is like, do you just go in and do it? And that was what I was talking about with like biting the bullet. Substack, I have mixed feelings about, because like I know a lot of writers who I respect who were on Substack who have openly like who've left the platform to go start a newsletter somewhere else, like at Ghost or whatever, because they say that Substack's taking too much of people's money. It's an ecosystem that is supporting a bunch of like fringy far right, you know, intellectuals. And like they have beefs with the business itself that make me wonder if Substack's the right place to be. But I don't boycott it because I'm not big on consumer politics. I think I said that in a past episode. But also like just because I'm not big on consumer politics doesn't mean that I'm like ready to throw my energy and my money at some terrible machinery or whatever. So like I've been ambivalent this whole time. Also, like I don't have a ton of time.
Well, I was gonna to say, write, Finn,
you know, like
also doesn't this sort of take away energies you've devoted elsewhere, like Duck of Minerva? You know, you have regular columns now.
Yeah.
Just be a regular column or.
So this is the column. So yeah, I'm still writing at the Duck. The way the Duck works though, like everything I write there is my copyright or whatever. So it's Creative Commons license. So like it can get syndicated and republished elsewhere. And so that's actually one of the points of attraction about writing for the Duck. I guess if I hadn't, there are some things that I would put in a newsletter that I'm not, it's not realistic to put in the Duck because like I'm already flirting with like very political analysis, and the Duck is more like straight up and down IR, even though these lines are getting like fuzzier and fuzzier in recent years. And I'm like the fuzziest of all, I think. But in a newsletter, I can like say what the fuck needs to be said straight up. And I don't have to worry about like, well, who's the audience? Well, the audience is whoever fucking subscribes, man.
Yeah.
So like probably podcast people. So yeah, I don't know. I'd probably republish Duck stuff in the newsletter. I don't know. I guess, I haven't, I'm going to do this at some point, I think, especially around book promotion time. It seems like a no-brainer. The ideal would be to like set up a newsletter that is syndicated somewhere else. So like there's some site that publishes things that appear in the newsletter or vice versa. And that like working out that kind of publishing relationship. I don't know. I haven't bothered to like navigate that or explore that space yet. So also, I'm just busy doing other stuff. All right, gang, that's going to do it. Buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic to buy us coffees. And we have a new merch store, actually. The old merch store is still available. We're not going to take it down because it doesn't cost anything to keep it up. But the new one is bonfire.com/store/undiplomatic. Excellent merch. So check it out. Easy URL. Catch you next time. Peace.